Hey, everybody. Today's episode of Day 2 Cloud is sponsored by Datadog, and you've probably heard them. They're a pretty popular monitoring platform for cloud-scale infrastructure and applications. If you'd like to know more, you can visit datadog.com/day2cloud and get your free Datadog t-shirt. That's datadog.com/day2cloud. Are you working on a personal project or managing enterprise infrastructure? You know, if so, you deserve simple, affordable, and accessible cloud computing solutions that allow you to take that project to the next level. You can simplify your cloud infrastructure with Linode's Linux virtual machines and develop, deploy, and scale your modern applications faster and easier. Want to get started with Linode today? You can get $100 in free credit just for listeners of the Day 2 Cloud podcast. Just go to linode.com/day2cloud. That's D-A-Y, the number 2, cloud.
Ned, I don't really care what you think about this. This was like the best conference ever. KubeCon and Cloud Native Con, no matter what you say, it was amazing. It was absolutely awesome. And that you disagree with... Oh, hey, dude, we're recording. Cool. Time to put on radio voices. Oh. And
yes,
welcome to Day 2 Cloud. There it is. Hey, welcome to Day 2 Cloud. So, Ned and I were just talking about the conference. We have a two-part show for you today. Two-part show. Ned and I are going to talk about KubeCon and Cloud NativeCon North America 2020 virtual event. And then we're going to talk to Riverbed about how to automate troubleshooting. So first up, Ned, we're going to get into this whole KubeCon Cloud NativeCon virtual event. And Ned, before we get into the conference itself, there were at least 50 vendor announcements that I counted because they sent them all on a big list to us. And and I picked out a few here that I thought we'd go through because they were from vendors that I thought our audience might care about, Ned. That would they'd care, dang it.
I hope they do. I mean, they tuned in to listen to us talk about KubeCon, so ostensibly, they're interested in announcements that center around that concept. Though I will say, what was most surprising to me was that the number of vendor announcements far exceeded the number of just KubeCon announcements. Things like graduating projects and new members. Like, there was that, but it was really very vendor-centric, which is ironic given their messaging of avoiding vendor lock-in.
Actually, the whole event felt very vendor centric to me. There were a lot of sponsored sessions, and you know, and so on. So I didn't know that they had emphasized not sponsory because it felt very vendory sponsory the whole event to me. So if they had said that, I definitely missed the memo and did not interpret that at all. Having attended the event for many hours this week, that was interesting. Right. Well, let's get into some announcements, Ned. Sysdig introduces low-touch, zero-trust network security for Kubernetes. I picked this one out. Well, I mean, Sysdig, a lot of people know what they're all about. And what they're saying here is the addition, this is a quote, the addition of a new security workflow in the Sysdig Secure DevOps platform, and there are different approaches to zero-trust in Kubernetes, native and non-native. Sysdig's announcement expands on why a Kubernetes-native approach, none of that non-native crap, it's a native approach to zero trust is the safest approach. Booyah.
I mean, that's great. I'm excited for them. I attended a Sysdig presentation for one of the cloud field days, and I was really impressed by their technology and their approach of using eBPF as their sort of like core mechanism for a lot of what they do. And the way that they think about networking is not so packet-centric. They think of networking from the container view and being able to capture a lot of things that are happening, not necessarily on the wire anymore. I lend some credence to this claim, even if it sounds a little press releasey.
It is press releasey because it was, in fact, a press release. So, yes.
Well, there we go.
That's why it sounds that way. But the thing to me is just the maturing of Kubernetes security as a model and the fact that there is a deeper need for that. I can correlate this back to one of the sessions that I attended from KubeCon where the need for security was discussed in some detail and it was articulated more than once that basically no one knows how to do it. It's really hard. So finding people that are experts in Kubernetes security is kind of a big deal.
Right. And they're trying to grow more. And I think we had this further down the list, but it seems like a good time to bring it up. One of the announcements that did come out of KubeCon was the official availability of their security exam and accreditation.
Yeah, the Kubernetes Security Specialist Certification is now available. Mm-hmm. That's been officially announced. The CKS is a 2-hour performance-based cert exam. There's a prerequisite. You need to be a certified Kubernetes administrator first. Then you can sit this exam if you want. And it's a remote exam with a live proctor monitoring you via webcam and screen sharing. Thou shalt not go to the bathroom while taking this test. We can't see you. Get back in your chair right now. It's that kind of a thing. And then once you earn the CKS, Kubernetes Security Specialist Certification, it is valid for 2 years. So yeah, apparently the whole ecosystem is becoming increasingly aware of the need for Kubernetes security experts.
The next one that you picked out was one that actually caught my eye, which was Equinix triples investment in Cloud Native Computing Foundation to fuel open source innovation. And I'll read the quote here. Mm-hmm. Equinix Inc., the world's digital infrastructure company, today announced it has tripled its investment in the cloud native community with an expanded commitment to Cloud Native Computing Foundation Community Infrastructure Lab, which is like a lot of words, but what does it actually mean? Well, they picked up this company called Packet over the past year. And what Packet does is make bare metal servers available as a service. So it's bare metal as a service. And I've actually used it to do some benchmarking tests. And it's pretty slick. Like mm-hmm. you can just say, I want an ESXi server, or I just want bare metal and I'm going to provide my own boot image, and you can get some pretty top of the line bare metal stuff. It's pretty awesome. So Equinix bought them, and something that Packet had been doing is offering this bare metal as a service to open source projects for free up to a certain cap. And basically Equinix is tripling that cap to make it available for even more open source projects to, in theory, increase the amount of innovation that's happening. And being able to do it on a bare metal platform is important for certain applications.
Up to $1 million a year, I'm assuming, per community member, because $1 million by itself wouldn't necessarily be all that much. But yeah, so good commitment from Equinix to the Cloud Native Computing Foundation. And, you know, so I'll make a comment here about the Cloud Native Computing Foundation. I attended because I registered as part of the media, which makes me feel weird, but I did. I got invited to a bunch of media and analyst sorts of sessions, and I listened to hours of these, and much of that conversation drove me a little bonkers because it wasn't about the projects. The content was about how amazingly awesome and helpful and wonderful the Cloud Native Computing Foundation is. Oh my gosh, they're so great. I heard that messaging so much, it was making me nuts. It's like, it's great that the CNCF is there. All the projects that they are incubating are important. They provide government. They provide legal counsel. They are doing things that are critical to the success of an open source project. I get it. I don't care. I care about the projects. I really care about the projects. And don't get me wrong. There was plenty of talk about various projects and their statuses and certain ones that have graduated and so on. But I heard so much of this kind of messaging in the panel discussions and such that I was like, is there a perception problem the CNCF has? Is someone in the media like got an axe to grind with them and thinks they're doing bad work or they don't understand what they're there for or something? I couldn't figure it out. It felt like they were talking to someone and trying to prove their value.
Well, there was that whole dust up with them and Google and Istio earlier this year, and then Google and some other people went out and formed a completely different organization to handle open source trademarking. And I think the CNCF felt a little slighted that Istio didn't end up as one of their projects and that Google refused to, you know, relinquish control of it. And maybe this is part of that, like trying to posture themselves as still being very important, which they are. But like, if you have to tell everybody how cool you are, how cool are you?
Yeah. Okay. So this dust up, I was not aware of. So you've made me a little smarter here. I feel like I've got some insight because it makes sense. One of the projects that they were parading around was Envoy. So, okay, if Istio isn't under the CNCF umbrella, but Envoy has been and remains, well, I mean, they're not, you know, most people talk about Istio and Envoy in the same breath. They aren't the same project, mm-hmm. but they're certainly closely related and often deployed together, control plane and data plane for sidecar proxies. But I don't know. Maybe that explains it, Ned.
To a certain degree, Envoy is really the 800-pound gorilla to me because it's not just being used for Istio. It's being used for a bunch of other applications. In fact, one of the startups that I work with, Solo.io, their API gateway uses Envoy on the back end. Mm-hmm. It's the control plane, and then Envoy is the data plane for everything that they do.
Yep.
And a number of other projects use it in the same way. So for me, Envoy is the more important and critical aspect of that. Mm-hmm. And whether Istio continues to be the preferred service mesh or if something else takes over, well, that's a conversation we can have a little further down in the program.
Okay. Another announcement here, Mirantis Lens adds extension API offering seamless integration with any Kubernetes integrated component, toolkit, or service. Well, what is Lens? Lens is the Kubernetes IDE. I had not heard of this tool before, and I watched a YouTube video that was just a screenshot of people using Lens to interact with a Kubernetes cluster, and I want it desperately, and I can have it, Ned. I can have it. It's open source, and it's free, at least at this.
Whoa.
Lens is super cool, man, and it's an IDE. When I hear IDE, Integrated Development Environment, I think of programming and coding and all that stuff, but it's more than, there are other use cases, is what I'm trying to say. Words are hard. Other use cases would include operations stuff and DevOps and so on. So as a Kubernetes operator, which tends to be my point of view, right, Ned, I'm looking at infrastructure as an operator, as an engineer. The insights it gave you, Lens, that is, and the interface into what's happening on the Kubernetes cluster, what the state the nodes are in, what workloads have been spun up on this thing, whether there's any issues, the aggregation of logs, it shows you Prometheus information integrated. It's all just right there for you. Dude, Lens is super cool. So I didn't know when I had started this reading this announcement what Lens was all about and dug in. And it's like, okay, they've added an extension API and I almost don't care because I didn't know what Lens was. And now I know what Lens is and it seems really interesting and I want to spend some time playing with it.
I actually want to spend some time playing with it too. I hadn't heard about it. So we're 2 for 2 on that one. Let's just pause the recording right now and go play with Lens for a while.
I know, right? another announcement here. Instana. I've done some briefings and brief stuff with Instana and covered some of their earlier announcements when they were first coming to market. They're an observability company. Their announcement here is Instana allows Kubernetes-based deployment and management of self-hosted on-prem version of application performance management solution, which is a lot of words. That means if you want to spin up Instana to do its observability magic in the same way you manage all your other Kubernetes apps, now you can. Instana can be stood up in a Kubernetes cluster in the same sort of a way, and you can stand it up yourself and do that. So pretty straightforward, not like we observe more and betterer. It's more like the way you deploy Instana just got better if you're a committed Kubernetes shop. So made good sense to me.
Yeah. I'm assuming they're jumping on the operator model here to deploy their software. And that makes sense. And observability continues to be the buzzword of the year. So everybody that was monitoring is now observability. And whether or not that's actually what they do, I can feel Charity Major's twitching right now, but that is what all the vendors are claiming.
It is a big word. Some Grafana person whose name, I'm sorry, I forgot your name, but she had reached out to me to give him a quote about why observability is a thing. And my quote was something fairly straightforward, like, because we can't see what's going on and the stacks keep getting more complicated and we used to know how it worked and we don't freaking know how it works anymore. So observability is going to remain not just the word of 2020, but probably one of the words of 2021 as well, Ned.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for that. Yeah. Is that all you're giving me? Yeah. Is that what we're down to, Ned? Just yeah.
I feel like you want to get into the Spectral Cloud thing. I don't want to slow you down.
Spectral Cloud releases self-hosted version of award-winning solution for enterprise Kubernetes infrastructure stack management. This is another thing where it wasn't new features necessarily. It was just new deployment method for Spectral Cloud. So they're all about, they had an as a service offering and now you can go self-hosted if you want to go the Spectral Cloud style of Kubernetes management. And you can do it any way you want. You want to do a public cloud, private cloud, bare metal. Now you can do Spectral Cloud in all the ways. I did a briefing in brief on Spectral Cloud as well near and around the time that they launched. So, all right. I think, Ned, that was all the announcements, right?
I mean, there were a lot more, but those are the ones that I felt I agree were probably the most relevant to the audience.
Okay.
The Spectral Cloud thing is interesting to me because I think a lot of managed Kubernetes solutions are doing this choose your own adventure kind of have it your way type thing. So mm-hmm. you can either run their managed component on premises and self-host. You can have the management component running up in the cloud as a SaaS service. You can run their platform on your own metal. You can run it on rented metal from one of the cloud providers as an IaaS solution. So they're really trying to give you all of the potential options and flexibility and just provide a more managed experience of Kubernetes. And for those who are just kind of dipping their toe into things, that probably makes the most sense. You don't want to be responsible for managing all components of Kubernetes if you don't have to.
So this leads me into some of the technical sessions that I watched from KubeCon that were not like media and analyst oriented, because a managed solution definitely feels like the way to go for me. I won't take you through all the sessions that I sat in. I did just a few, not that many, but there's still some hours of watching and taking notes that I got behind me. And Ned, I got the sense that Kubernetes lacks maturity, which the Kubernetes people would push back and go, oh no, it's stable, man. We've like stopped pumping all these features into it. It's like, we're all like chill and so on. No. Okay. No, not in the sense that most of us that are commercial software consumers that are used to things like, oh, I have a maintenance family train that I can follow if I don't want to be on the bleeding edge new features train all the time. I don't think Kubernetes is there in that same sort of a way that those of us that have been consuming, again, commercial software for the last 20 something years would kind of think of it. I still feel like it's a rapidly developing ecosystem. Because architectural problems keep coming up. So I'll take apart one session that I watched where they were talking about some network load balancing problems. The idea was, the way they stated the problem, and I probably don't have all the details right here, so if you two watch this session or are familiar with this problem and I don't have all the details right, don't beat me up too badly. But roughly stated, kubeproxy, which is that's a fundamental construct in a Kates cluster and how traffic gets moved around and distributed, it doesn't load balance across node endpoints especially well in certain circumstances, especially when you're dealing with a large cluster, you're dealing with multiple clusters. Well, why doesn't kubeproxy load balance especially well? There's no metadata. Kubeproxy doesn't really know what's going on when it directs work to a particular endpoint. It sends the work back there, and it could be that that endpoint's like, I'm dying, and it just gave me more work to do. That's bad. And so when you have a problem like that, that ramps up your application transaction time and so on. And so the rest of the discussion after they set up what this problem was, all right, how do we make kubeproxy smart enough that it can direct work to where it geographically should, a locality that makes sense, but to an endpoint that can actually handle it and so on. And there was so much head scratching and I'm like, wait a minute, this is like a fundamental load balancing distributed computing problem. And we've had this problem for a long time, and there's lots of solutions in this space, but Kubernetes is dealing with this now. So, I just use that as an example of like, it lacks maturity. They haven't run into all the things that they're going to run into yet as different companies deploy this. More and more of these fundamental architectural problems are popping up. Now, I don't know if this particular issue that was cited in this session, Ned, was like a really common problem a lot of people deal with, but it was big enough that there are three KEPs that they've added. I forget what KEP stands for, but basically it's like an issue. It's an open issue that they opened. KEP 1659, they want to introduce standard topology labels. KEP 2004, they want to introduce topology-aware routing. And then KEP 2030, endpoint slice subsetting. These are all things that you'd end up putting into YAML to inform kubeproxy some information that it might then be able to use to more effectively load balance and stuff. I've gotten into too much detail, Ned, but again, it's that maturity thing.
Right. I see what you're saying. And like you said, this is a problem that we have solved for before. And it almost seems like maybe kubeproxy isn't the thing that should be doing this. Maybe there's a way to make use of other existing technologies and bring those in instead of trying to force an existing component to do something it was never designed to do. It's that shoehorning of functionality that you see in some immature products. And the maturity process is weeding out the stuff that doesn't work and offloading that work to something that does. And I kind of thought that was the whole point of like the CNCF landscape and all these other projects, was Kubernetes should be really good at one thing. And then if you need something like really intelligent load balancing, that should be handled by a different project. Today's episode of Day 2 Cloud is sponsored by Datadog, a monitoring platform for cloud-scale infrastructure and applications. Datadog provides dashboarding, alerting, application performance monitoring, and log management in one tightly integrated platform so you can get end-to-end visibility quickly. And it integrates seamlessly with AWS so you can start monitoring EC2, RDS, ECS, and all your other AWS services in minutes. Visualize key metrics, set alerts to identify anomalies, and collaborate with your team to troubleshoot and fix issues fast. Try it yourself by starting a free 14-day trial and installing the agent. Plus, you'll get a free Datadog t-shirt. Visit datadog.com/day2cloud to get started. That's datadog.com/daytwocloud to get started.
We had a briefing before KubeCon with Isovalent, which just launched. That's the commercial variant of the Cilium project. And we don't need to get into that in much detail. But Cilium, as I remember, correct me if I'm wrong here, it replaces KubeProxy entirely. Or that's something that it can do. And I wonder if there's more intelligent load balancing functionality in there, you know, for example. So it wouldn't be, it's a different way to build out that load balancing functionality, perhaps.
I believe I was on that briefing as well, and I believe you're correct. That is the way that they framed it. So we'll see if something else comes along to clobber it out for those peak use cases where you actually have that problem. Because if I'm just running a Minikube cluster locally, I'm not going to have this problem. I don't need to install Cilium for that.
Right. Yes. Right. a couple of the technical sessions that I attended, just a few comments. One, I attended what they called a 101 session, which was essentially taking your application from a VM-hosted infrastructure to a Kubernetes infrastructure, and how do you do that? And they walked you through Dockerizing your application, so in other words, taking it and making it into a container. Now, Kubernetize it from there. Now that you've got a container, they actually use the word Kubernetize. Now you've got to set up your networking. Now you've done that. Okay, now we can get to the thing. Now we've got to set up logging. Okay, great, logging. We can see what's going on. All right, now let's set up some metrics. We can actually track performance and so on. And now that that's all ready, we're all set to go migrate and DNS. That's how you do it. You just DNS and everything goes over to the new cluster now and it's all great. So they talked about that for a good hour and change with a lot of the details. Mm. It was really a well done presentation, I thought, because they basically gave you a bulletized list of the big issues you need to think about when moving over. And they talked about a lot of the gotchas and the concerns along the way. One final comment I got to make about all the sessions I attended, Ned, was in the closing keynote, which as we're recording, this was actually today, they mentioned that an overwhelming number of people surveyed would prefer a 3 times per year release cycle versus a 4 times per year release cycle, which made me laugh very much. It's like, really? I mean, obviously, right? How about two? How about one? How about a dev train and a stable train? How about something like that, maybe? I don't know. It's just too exhausting to keep up with it.
Yeah, I would agree with probably two times a year is probably the max that most enterprises are going to be willing to attempt. And honestly, they're probably only going to do one update a year. And that's just what they're going to be comfortable with. It's the dev shops and the move fast, break things kind of philosophy that'll keep up on that, you know, 3x a year release train. And good for them if that makes sense. You know, that's why you need to have, like you said, two different update trains. And Windows Server does this, for goodness sake. Now they have a semi-annual release and then they have their long-term supported version. And you can do the semi-annual, which is cutting edge for Windows. Or you can do the long term where you just get like security updates and you don't get any new features, but that's fine.
Well, to me, what is emphasized when you read new Kubernetes release notes is new features. They talk about the stuff that the different feature sets and what and kind of what train they're in within the release. So like this is an alpha release, these new features, et cetera, et cetera. But still, if I'm a company and I just want bug fixes on some of the other stuff that I'm using, I don't care about new features. I would want that maintenance train. So, Ned, Dude, I have been dominating this conversation. I have been saying so many words. And I know there was stuff that you were observing. What haven't we talked about yet that's on your mind about KubeCon and Cloud Native Con 2020?
Well, something grabbed my attention. I think it was in the opening keynote. And they said, container usage is up 300%. And I was like, wow, That's an exceptional number.
Yeah, like since last year, I would assume, right?
That would be the natural assumption when someone says something like that. And it was based off of their cloud native survey for 2020.
Yeah.
And so I went and I looked at that survey because I was like, I'm curious. And it turns out container usage is up 300% versus 2016 numbers.
Oh.
I'm like, well, I guess that's true. Why don't you just go back to go back to the year 2000 and you could say container usage is up infinity percent.
Infinity percent. No one was using them. Now everyone's using them.
It was a very strange, and it made me kind of wonder, why would you lead with that? Why would that be the statistic that you lead with in your report and in your keynote? Is that because other things are, because people are so used to the hockey stick graph, they're just demanding to see that hockey stick still, and you don't have it anymore because you're reaching a point where the percentages have to slow down because of the rules of large numbers. That's just how it works. So for those who are actually interested, the increase was from 84% in 2019 to 92% in 2020 running containers in production. So it was an 8% increase, not 300. If we're doing year over year, like a normal human being.
So in other words, container adoption is slowing down. That's what we're reading.
It's slowing down. Because we're at 92%, like there's not a whole lot further to go. So yeah, of course it's going to slow down, and that's fine. That's not a bad thing.
Yeah, boy, exactly. Why would you lead with that? Why did they need to put it that way? I don't know. Maybe some of it's like we've had a bunch of conversations with VMware, and we know there's a lot of enterprises that are not rushing to cloud native, and there's a million legitimate reasons why that might be the case. So maybe it's trying to point out that no, even though there's VMC on AWS and similar technologies that allows people to maintain their good old virtual machines, containers still matter, man. We're still charging down the road and we're all going cloud native. I think we know the landscape is much more complicated than that.
Yes, indeed we do. Another interesting stat from the survey was only 27% are using a service mesh in production. So despite all the noise and hype around service mesh, about a quarter of organizations are actually using it in production today. And that was a little surprising. I assumed it would be higher for some reason. The top three service meshes that are being used, Istio is number one. Yep. So like I said earlier in the show, that's the number one service mesh.
Okay.
Followed by Linkerd being number two. And then interestingly, HashiCorp's console was number three. So kind of an interesting mix there. I expected the first two. I was a little surprised by the third. I thought it would be one of like the cloud specific type service meshes to take the third spot in that.
It's the complexity, I believe, Ned. So my take is when you add a service mesh into the mix and now you've got this complex proxy that can do all this cool stuff for you. You've now complicated your troubleshooting chain. You've complicated your instrumentation requirements, your observability. And that's great if you need what the service mesh brings you, with a lot of flexibility there. But if you don't need it, do you want it? And I think more and more companies are realizing maybe I don't need this just because people like you and me are yapping about it. I don't know that that means everyone needs it, right?
Well, that was. So I attended a media panel as well as a service mesh specific panel, and Matt Klein was from Lyft was on both of those panels, and his messaging was pretty consistent across both panels, which is you probably don't need a service mesh.
Hmm.
And in fact, he actually took it a step further and said, we're asking the wrong question if we're asking if you need a service mesh. What we should be asking is, do you even need a microservices application to begin with?
Huh, very interesting. I have in my browser tab right before me now a blog post from Christian Posta. Istio is an example of when not to do microservices. So he's not talking about Istio, how you'd use it, but just the developing back end and how they decided to turn it back into a monolith. I got to get through that post. But
right. During one of the other panelists, Lynn from, I believe, IBM, was talking about project they were working on, an application that they had broken into microservices, and then they realized that they didn't have any of the problems that microservices were meant to solve, and so they consolidated that application back into a monolith and it fixed a bunch of the issues they were having running it as a microservice. So,
yeah, but how do they feel not being cool? Because now they're not cool.
I mean, they're IBM, so I don't think they're that concerned about it. Let's be honest.
Fair enough.
I think she might have actually come from the Red Hat side, so they might care a little bit. But I mean, it was an interesting conversation. So both of those panels were interesting, and it led me to do a YouTube video where I kind of talked a little bit about, do you need a service mesh? Mm-hmm. And I'd actually like to do an expanded version of that as a Day 2 Cloud show. If listeners are interested, we could maybe get like Matt Klein or some other people who have a contrarian view to the service mesh hype.
Oh, let's reach out to Matt and see if he can make some time for us. I'm in the Day 2 Cloud audience. I'd like to hear that show.
Great. Yeah. Linode has 11 global data centers and provides 24/7/365 human support with no tiers or handoffs, regardless of your plan size. That's pretty convenient. In addition to shared and dedicated compute instances, you could use that $100 in credit on S3 compatible object storage, managed Kubernetes, and more. Host your website, build your app, store or backup media. You know what? It's up to you. You can do whatever you want. It's all free with that $100 of Linode credit. So how do you get started? Go and visit linode.com. That's linode.com/day2cloud, D-A-Y, the number 2, cloud, and click on create free account to get started. And be sure to check out Linode's new YouTube channel for video tutorials, security tips, and more at youtube.com/Linode. And you know what? You might even see a familiar face. One more time, that's linode.com/day2cloud to get your free $100 in Linode credit. That was very interesting to me, the cloud native survey, and also the whole conversation around service mesh and the fact that it hasn't seen skyrocketing adoption leads me to believe that a lot of people are doing that calculus and going, I don't need it. Another interesting thing from this was that 55% of those that they surveyed are using stateful containers in production. And I know that's a thing, but to me, I thought it would be a lot less prevalent than that. And I was like, wow.
I thought it'd be like real specific workloads that need state because reasons, databases and such. 55% sounds like, I mean, it's almost like the preferred way to do it. And that's not the way containers are supposed to be.
Or if, you know, speaking of your 101 session, a lot of people are going through that migration process of moving these traditional applications from a VM to a container to Kubernetes, and that is going to need that stateful backend. And the most popular stateful backends were all cloud storage platforms. So,
because of course.
Yes, exactly. Yep. So Google and AWS and Azure's storage backend that they provide for their Kubernetes service, those were the top three because that's where those stateful workloads are running. So I thought that's kind of interesting too. Mm.
Did you get a take on serverless? I'm just curious if that showed up in the survey because we haven't talked about it much at all after talking about it nonstop, it felt like, in 2019.
Yes. So based off the survey, most people are not using serverless. It was only like 22% of respondents that are actually using serverless in production. And when they do, they're using the cloud, mostly Lambda, but also Azure Functions and Google Cloud Run. OpenFaz and Knative were a distant fourth and fifth place in that whole hierarchy. And those would be sort of the maybe on-prem, but you can also run those in just a regular Kubernetes cluster. So serverless is still a thing.
I wonder if it's an understanding thing, like how do I leverage this? How do I fit it into my world? Because it does feel like, especially in the context that it's being used, Lambda, you know, in other words, it's costing you money to run these. If you are running more serverless, you are saving money, or at least that's an argument that's been made a lot of times.
I would say the inverse is what's actually usually true. Is if you're running a steady state workload and you're using serverless, you're probably paying too much for it. Because the cost of running the serverless resources is higher than just running an EC2 instance.
Oh, the early numbers were the opposite of that, right? I know Amazon, when they were trying to encourage Lambda adoption, were saying, like, you can save 80%. Why sit here and run something in EC2 when you can just run your function, we spin it up, give you back the results, spin it back down again? In theory, it was going to be cheaper. I guess not.
No, serverless likes bursty kind of workloads where there will be times where no computation is being done, and then these big spikes where it can scale out and then scale way back in. And then you can save a bunch of money, because otherwise you'd have to keep a whole farm of EC2 instances and use auto scaling and all that. Lambda turns out to be cheaper in that case, but that is a specific use case. Mm-hmm, and because mm-hmm. of the limited size of that use case, that probably is why the number of people using serverless is lower than you might think. It's because they've looked at it and they've said, well, it works for this one thing that we need to do, but everything else still makes sense to run in a container or a VM. So that's what we're going to do for everything else. I think that's where we're at. Maybe people are actually looking at the business requirements and the technical requirements and then making intelligent decisions.
It's not just the cool kids club messing with all these nifty cloud things. Now it's about the business and figuring out what this is actually costing. Yeah, I get it.
Absolutely. Yeah. One of the things that I did notice, and what I was kind of alluding to earlier in the conversation when we're talking about all these vendor PR announcements, was in every presentation I saw, whether it was a keynote or just a regular kind of session, almost every single one mentioned avoiding vendor lock-in as a reason to embrace these open source technologies.
Yes.
And I think there's a much larger conversation we can have, and we certainly don't have time for it today, but vendor lock-in, as we've maybe even expressed before, is a myth. You're locked in somewhere. You're always locked in. And the way that you pay for that lock-in is going to be different. The pain you're going to experience is going to be different. But there's, as soon as you make any decision, you are now locked in.
Dude, I couldn't agree more. I did a short YouTube video on this on my youtube.com/Ethan Banks. I believe you can find it there. It's about 4 or 5 minutes worth. I agree with you. That was what I expressed. You're locked into something. You're locked into something.
Well, they don't seem to think so. If you use open source, you can just avoid lock-in like crazy, apparently. And lock-in's the enemy.
I don't know. I agree. That did come up so much. It drove me a little bit crazy, but... Well, anyway, that is it for Ned and I in this segment of Day 2 Cloud. Stay tuned. We are going to talk to Riverbed now, and we are going to get into the topic of automating troubleshooting, which sounds like nonsense, but it isn't. Not exactly. That is, you're going to have issues in your complicated application delivery infrastructure, a lot of the components of which we were just talking about. So the idea is, what reactions can you automate when there's a problem to make the troubleshooting process useful and timely and helpful and all that? And Riverbed's going to get into that with us. The big idea, reduce your MTTR, mean time to resolution. Thank you for joining us today on our Cloud Native Con KubeCon 2020 roundup and discussion with Riverbed on automating troubleshooting. Virtual high fives to you for tuning in. You are pretty awesome. If you have suggestions for future shows, things you want Ned and I to cover, hit us up on Twitter at Day2CloudShow or fill out the form on Ned's fancy website, nedinthecloud.com. The Packet Pushers Podcast Network, of which Day2Cloud is a proud member. Well, the Packet Pushers Podcast Network has a weekly newsletter, Human Infrastructure Magazine. We don't sell your info. Geez, it's a newsletter for you, from us to you, filled with love. It's loaded with all the best stuff that we found on the internet, plus our own feature articles and commentary. It is free and it does not suck. Get the next issue via packetpushers.net/newsletter. And until then, just remember, cloud is what happens while IT is making other plans. Welcome to the Tech Bytes portion of Day 2 Cloud, and we have with us today Chris Eckert from Riverbed, and our story today is about automating troubleshooting. And I actually got a little bit excited about this when I was talking to the Riverbed team about what's going on here, because there is AI and ML in a use case that takes us down the road eventually to being able to react to things that are being seen on the network and automate some troubleshooting. And we're going to get into this with Chris and explain how this can work today and how it might work even better in the future. So Chris, let's set it up this way. For some companies, Wireshark and a laptop, hey, that's good enough. That's the solution. I've been at some shops like that. But there are also situations where that is clearly not good enough. Wireshark and a laptop, that's just not the thing. So how do I get ready to troubleshoot before I need to?
The Wireshark on a laptop is something's wrong and you run around switch to switch and try and capture it. It's extremely reactive. The step up from that is to have those spans, those packet feeds available someplace right away. And second, to capture them all the time, to stop thinking, okay, this is a problem I need to capture, and instead write packets to disk and say, okay, we had a problem at this time. Let's go back and look at what the packets say. Put that alongside of NetFlow, which can be watching every conversation move everywhere, but not giving you that in-depth data like the packets give you. And now you've taken that next step. Now you can troubleshoot on demand for things that have already happened instead of being reactive.
Which one's the span port I set up? I've been in that scenario with the laptop in my arm going, oh, I think it was card 3, port 28, whatever. Yeah, you want to be ahead of the game there with that packet capture infrastructure so that you can, as realistically you're always going to need to be able to go, at 3 in the morning, X happened. Great, okay, let's dig through the database of packets and see what happened. All right, so I've got this troubleshooting infrastructure in place. Well, all right, it's 2020, Chris. I want to automate some of this. What are the sorts of things I could automate rather than react to someone sending me a help desk ticket?
When you are listening to those packets all the time, presumably in front of an application, and with those packets, you could go back and look at the response times that happened. But as those packets are coming in, you can be measuring response times for applications. So now all of a sudden, that application starts to slow down. And you cross some threshold, whether it's manually or automatically created, now you can alert and say, hey, this application is slowing down. So now instead of the call at 3 a.m. saying this happened an hour ago, you get this is becoming a problem. And you start to get, you know, you're taking the troubleshooting tool to the next level of monitoring.
So let's qualify that exactly. Is this a Riverbed tool that's doing this measurement for me? Is it sending data elsewhere or?
Sure. In our app response system, what effectively does packet capture, we do a couple of things at the same time as packets come in. We write them to disk, of course. We build metadata from them so that we can build reports in the app response that you can look back over time and see what's happening. And we also generate NetFlow from those tools. And this is a more enhanced NetFlow, whereas every conversation everywhere NetFlow view of the world shows you what's moving, what ports were used, and a few other bits of information, but doesn't give you response time and certainly no in-depth, you know, database error codes or anything. The app response adds some of that information to this NetFlow. So you can, from this packet capture world, integrate things like app response into that every conversation everywhere world as well. That gets you a different view of the world where in the app response or the packet capture, you're looking at response time for applications and alerting on them. The every conversation everywhere world, what we call NetProfiler, gives you the ability to say, okay, this is the, you know, these applications talk to these servers. Normal utilization on this link is this much. And by the way, I'm seeing response times from my app response as well. When something changes, alert on it, or if something crosses a utilization threshold, create an alert. And alerts from all these systems can go to, you name it, Splunk, ServiceNow, whatever you're doing with your alerts. We have a third tool that listens to devices. You know, the old SNMP, it's been around a long time. Add to that some other tricks like synthetic testing of applications. And take that data, and you can now start to alert on this application failed to respond in this amount of time, alert on it, or this interface on this router is showing errors that may become a problem or has utilization, alert on that. Now you're getting told this application's slow, this conversation for this application is running off the rails, or this device is starting to fail and producing a ticket as it's beginning rather than waiting until somebody's calling up saying, I can't get to this application.
Right. So you're pulling data, it sounds like, from, or at least you're culling the data from three different tools that you talked about. Is there some sort of unifying tool or unifying thing that can munge all that information together and create sort of actionable information?
Sure. We very imaginatively call it Portal. And so we can now, in the Portal, think of that application that costs you money when it goes down, or that is the one application that all of your associates have to be working in. build a report for that application and put in this response times for the database, all of the conversations going to the front end and from who, the devices that carry that, even a map of this web server to this database follows this path through the network down to the interface, and put that map right in this portal so that you can see if one of those interfaces starts to turn yellow, or if response times start to slow down, or if the web server suddenly begins talking to everybody on the planet. Now, in one page, you can look at all three of those devices, all three of those views of performance in one place for one topic.
As we all know, networking doesn't live in a vacuum, so I imagine you could also correlate maybe a slowdown with some hardware events that are happening with that server, or something from your storage system that could also tie into that. So is there an ability to integrate what you've got from Portal with other systems that, you know, your monitoring or ops team might already be using?
Yeah. And so here's where the world has changed in monitoring, in that all of a sudden everybody has shifted to API for communication between platforms. We can draw information from some other tools and put it in the portal. If you want to see device data, response times, and all the conversations, but you also need to see one other parameter that is outside of our realm, like number of users logged into some system or something, you could pull that into Portal. On the flip side of that, all of these systems are API driven. And so other tools can now start reaching in. You know, if a tool sees what it feels is a threat and wants to reach down and see everybody that this server talked to in the last 10, you know, you can use an API to pull that kind of information back to those other tools as well.
You're saying that the Riverbed tools have an API so that other tools can, as you said, reach in and get more information about some event that they're curious about.
Sure. And in this day and age, you almost have to have an open API.
Oh, and then you just said the other key word there, open, because sometimes these APIs is like, yeah, we have an API, but it's secret for our partners only. You're saying it's open, right?
We won't let you in unless right. You have secret
handshake. Well, that's a thing, right? You know, that's a thing.
Yep, it is. No, we don't do that. And that's what's changing the world now, isn't it? I mean, now you can't just rely on packets. You can't just rely on those conversations, because event correlation tools are out there and firewalls are alerting on things. And you have to be able to start to blend this data together to get to the bigger picture.
Another thing I want to go back here, speaking of bigger picture, I want to know how you actually formed the picture, like, oh, the web server's talking to the whole world now, or these flows seem anomalous. I don't think you said ML, maybe you did, but is this like basically machine learning and then artificial intelligence applied in some way to determine when things are going strangely?
Yeah. So if you can see every conversation everywhere, and you know this server talks to clients that are outside of your world and one server, a change to that behavior could be indicative of a threat. The nirvana is when an event like this started talking to loads of other boxes, the number of internal IPs just went off the scales. And then take that data and blend it with event correlation, or maybe a data exfiltration system's view of the world. And you start to come back with a very quickly and very automatedly built view of a threat. And so while these are troubleshooting systems at heart, the data that can be produced in them can be indicative of other threats. A packet capture device could start seeing 505 errors or authentication errors that are outside of the norm. And that might just be somebody fat fingering a bunch of stuff, but it might be somebody trying to break into that server. And if those same errors are seen elsewhere, it might be something starting to spread or trying to work its way through your network. So all of these data components have things that can be used by other systems that are meant to do other things as well.
You use the word nirvana there early on. Does that mean some of this is doable today and some of this is planned for the future?
Oh, no. Absolutely, some of this is doable right now. There are, I mean, we haven't built Skynet yet. You know, the complete autonomous AI system that can watch all of the data and think, oh, well, I think this person is a threat now. That may not be there, but the ability to enable machine learning to watch conversations over time as they change and alert or react when something is wrong, and then blend that with all these other tools via an API. There's the old term, the network is the computer. Well, it's gone past that to where now, you know, all of the things happening in your cloud and in your internal network and your virtualization being monitored, and individual systems thinking about things and saying, this doesn't look right. And another guy saying, this doesn't look right, pulling that data together and coming up with what's really going on. That's the nirvana, when those systems will tell you, yes, somebody's trying to break in. This is the server they're after. By the way, no data exfiltration has occurred, in one report automatically. That's nirvana. That's when you're told before something's a problem that the system stopped it from being a problem.
Right. And you mentioning the open APIs that are available from your systems, that helps it tie into the existing security systems that are out there. So whatever's going to generate that report has access to all of the data and can also automate a response when it sees something kind of funky happening.
Right. That's the common language that lets all of these things talk to each other. That was one of the most necessary parts. The AI is, you know, a variable that nobody's really sure how far it will go or how much is even needed, but the language had to happen first. So the API came around, and now we can do this.
Well, Chris Eckert, this was an interesting conversation here, understanding how Riverbed fits into the troubleshooting tool chain, I think is the right way to put it. Yeah, when you come from a tool world, a lot of times it's like, can I consolidate these tools? But the reality is making the tools work with one another is the future, as you put it. That's the modern way to be thinking about things. And so having them talk to one another is a big deal. And you guys, Riverbed, fit right into that troubleshooting tool chain. Again, for those of us who think about Riverbed as like the WAN optimization company, there's so much more going on here. So I'm glad we could have that conversation. If you're out there listening and you want to know more about what is going on in the world of Riverbed and troubleshooting, troubleshooting tools, troubleshooting tool chains, etc., you can visit their website. They have a landing page just for you, riverbed.com/day2cloud. That's riverbed.com/day2cloud. You can check out a whole bunch of digital discussions that we've been having with them there. You can also register for their user conference. The user conference happened on November 17th, but all of the content is available for you to review. It's there. Just register and you'll get access to all of that from the Riverbed user conference. And there's more coming from Riverbed. If you stay tuned and subscribe to Day 2 Cloud, you'll hear more as we chat with Riverbed in upcoming Tech Bytes discussions.